Welcome to the Alcohol Free Life podcast, brought to you by thesoberclub.com. I'm Genuinely Grace. This is for you if you've quit the booze or you'd like to, or maybe you're just sober curious. I'll bring you tips and motivation without any judgment, and there'll be inspiration from experts, quitlet authors, and sober heroes. Hi, and welcome to the Alcohol Free Life podcast. I'm Genuinely Grace. I really hope you're well. Don't forget, by the way, that you can follow me on social media at Genuinely Grace, and you can use a hashtag for the Sober Club. Make sure you keep up with all the stuff that's going on. And also, right at the start of the podcast, just a reminder that the Sober Club is there for you. We have members who are sober curious, right through to people who have been sober for, gosh, I think we've got one member who's 12 years or something, because it's all about the what's next. So I wanted to talk about the topic of anxiety and health anxiety, particularly today. So I've got a really interesting guest coming up a little bit later, who has really done an in-depth book on this whole topic, how to understand and deal with health anxiety, everything you need to know to manage health anxiety. She's Katie Georgiou, and It's a really interesting book, because the whole topic, we think, what is health anxiety? So we'll get into all of that. I mean, is it just that you want to take care of yourself, because that would be completely normal, or is it something more than that? So she looks into the science behind health anxiety, how it affects our mind and body, how we can get control of it. And the idea of the book is that we have a better understanding of what health anxiety is and how it manifests and how we can identify the symptoms. And of course, for those people, you know, who are ditching the booze, I mean, it's a really fascinating topic, because often the reason that we decide, okay, it's time to stop drinking, is that we recognize that we've got health concerns, we've got health issues. And we know, because, you know, none of us are completely stupid, we do know that drinking alcohol is not going to be doing us any favors. It is incredible, actually, how long it goes on with some of us, despite health things, despite little concerns and niggles, we still carry on. The amount of women with HRT and all kinds of symptoms, and they'll do anything but stop drinking. You know, they'll go through everything else and get the HRT and get the antidepressants and take all the stuff, but they won't remember this part. And I guess, well, that's the way society wants it to be, isn't it? But it really is incredible when often, you know, well, in every case, I would say that should be the first step. The absolute first step should be quit the booze and then have a look at what's going on. Then you can sort of start from a level playing field, can't you? And really, there isn't any health condition that stopping drinking doesn't help with, if you see what I mean. It's a bit of a double negative. But, you know, there isn't anything that will get worse. Let's put it that way. So your health is in no way going to get worse if you stop drinking. It can only, in many cases, get better or stay the same, but it most certainly isn't going to get worse. And I know so many people within the Sober Club that have found that their chronic conditions have just literally gone. You know, people with hay fever, people with asthma, people with all kinds of conditions. And that's before we even get on to emotional situations and anxiety and all kinds of other stuff. And, you know, I'm not a doctor. I'm not trying to give you medical advice, but I am saying that I absolutely know that you can't possibly do yourself any harm by quitting the booze. I mean, as long as, you know, just to caveat that, as long as you're not clinically dependent, in which case, of course, it is dangerous to stop. You know that, you know, the messages I give are for those people who are what we call grey area drinkers. They're somewhere on that spectrum. They're not at rock bottom, but they're drinking more than they want to. And if that's you, then you can absolutely quit the booze. And oh my goodness, it'll be the best thing you've ever done for your health and well-being. So there was a piece I saw recently. I just wanted to mention this. It was a Huffington Post article, actually. And it was written by a doctor, no less, and an author and a neurologist. And they were talking about, in this article, he was talking about how to prevent dementia. And the headline was around drinking, and specifically about what age we should stop drinking. So In this piece, this doctor was suggesting, admitting that, alcohol is not a good idea. It's really not very good for you. But he does say you have less to fear if you're drinking wine for social enjoyment or tasting reasons. I mean, seriously? What on earth does that sentence actually mean? I would love to challenge him to a debate. If you're drinking wine for social enjoyment, well, yeah, of course that's what you think you're doing. I mean, that kind of gives the impression that you're having just a little sip, once a year. Don't be ridiculous. We were all drinking wine for social enjoyment. It's just that, by the time we'd finished off the bottle, there was not much more enjoyment left and we were on a right slippery slope, yeah? So that's crazy. And then he goes on to say, I strongly suggest that if you are 65 years or older, that you completely and permanently eliminate alcohol from your diet. Well, yes, duh. Why 65? Why 65? I just cannot believe this article. Yet again, it's another article that would have literally kept me stuck till I was 65. I'd be like, okay, then, well, I'm sure everything's absolutely fine. But, by the time I get to 65, I'll do it then. Come on. If not now, when? What a ridiculous state of affairs. By the time you get to 65, all of the miserable health things will have already kicked in. Not to mention the fact that you'll be absolutely missing out on living your best life. That's the bit that really frustrates me about these kinds of articles that literally just keep you stuck. I can only begin to take a wild guess. And, if you're listening, the author of this piece, please do challenge me. But I'm just guessing that that's something that's probably going on in your own life. Maybe you quite like drinking, you don't want to stop yet. So you're not willing to open up your eyes to the fact that life is so much better without alcohol. And a couple of weeks ago, I did a TV piece with Millie from Sober Girl Society. And we did a piece for TV for BBC London around quitting booze. And the piece was all based around age, because the main reporter has just stopped drinking. She's only in her 20s. Millie stopped when she was in her late 20s. And of course, little old me, the old one, didn't stop till I was in my 50s. But, as I said in that piece, I mean, of course, it's never too late. But as soon as you are aware, as soon as you wake up to this, that's when you'd be wanting to stop, right? And literally my only regret is I didn't do this sooner. Why, oh, why did I carry on for so long when I could, I had some opportunities, but perhaps just not enough support. Perhaps that's what it was, and not enough connection. And we know that, the power of connection within all of this, it's absolutely key. Making sure that you're with like-minded people, you've got self-care in place, you're doing all the pieces. It's so critical to do all of that stuff. Anyways, that brings me back to this topic of anxiety, because in addition to people deciding to stop because of these various health conditions, physical health conditions, lots of people do recognize, okay, I've got anxiety and it's continuing, and I'm anxious about the fact that I'm anxious. I'm anxious about the health conditions. I'm anxious just because I'm anxious. We don't know exactly what's going on, but we know that it's incredibly common for people to just have an anxiety that seems to go on and on. And one of my clients actually was saying that, or one of the Sober Club members said that she had relapsed. I hate that word, but she'd started drinking again. She got triggered by something upset her. She started drinking again, and she had a couple of drinks. But this time, rather than rolling straight into a long period of going back down the booze elevator, what happened was she actually really consciously noticed what happened. So she noticed how she felt, and she felt, as you might imagine, after being sober for a lot of months, 9 months or something, she felt a huge sense of shame and annoyance at herself, really irritated at herself. But she also noticed that she felt incredibly anxious, really, really anxious. And not just for a few hours, she kind of monitored how long the anxiety went on. And she said it went on for several weeks of feeling really anxious, even though she stopped again. And it helped her to see, I don't need that in my life. It's really not something I need in my life. And so, you know, she was able to use that blip, if you like, as a way of really helping her to remember, you know, I don't need to feel this level of anxiety anymore. I'd got to a point where I was able to start to feel balanced. And that's the power of choosing to be sober. And yes, the early weeks can be really difficult for people. There's no doubt about that. In the very early weeks, you might feel anxious, you might feel chaotic, you might feel a little bit unsure of who you even are while you're stepping into your sober shoes. But you have to hang on to the fact that it's going to get better. You know, this too shall pass, the tricky bits will pass, and you will come back to that fabulous place of balance and knowing who you really are. And that's the really beautiful part. And just before we get into the interview with my guest, Katie Georgiou, I just want to share a couple of things around anxiety with some of the kind of a couple of the tips and the tools that I've found so unbelievably beneficial. When I've done lots of workshops and work with lots of people who recognize that they do get anxious from time to time. You know, they do have a bit of a panic attack or a feeling of, you know, not being able to cope, feeling really overwhelmed. And there are a few really simple things that can make a difference. So one thing, and I know you'll have heard me speak about it before, but one thing is to just do simple breathing techniques. So box breathing is a really simple one where you kind of imagine you've got the sides of a box, as it were. You breathe in for four, across for four, down the side of the box for four, across the bottom of the box for four. It's just called box breathing. It really is just regulating, slowing down your breathing. And then you can do simple breathing techniques like breathing in for a count and breathing out for a longer count. So breathing exercises, most people know them now, but we forget to do them. We forget that actually we can bring ourselves back to our breath. We can let the breath take it. And the power of it is incredible. The other really beautiful technique is to stand straight, you know, the power pose, if you like, but also to stand with your feet hip width apart and place one hand on your heart. And this is linked to something called the heart math technique. If you're interested in that, look it up. It's really fascinating. But at its most simplistic, this is one of the exercises where you simply stand feet hip width apart, chest open, head up, place your hands on your heart. If you're comfortable to do so, close your eyes and slow down your breathing. So just focus on your breathing as you place your hand on your heart. Breathe in through the nose, out through the nose, just for a count of five, in and out. And then focus on someone or something you love unconditionally. So it could be a person, it might be a place, it might be a pet, but someone you love unconditionally. And just visualize that person, just focus on that person or that pet or that beautiful place, someone or something you love unconditionally, as you breathe in and out with your hands still on your heart. And then as you've done those rounds of whatever it is, 5-10 breaths, you can, if you like, another lovely tip is to do a little color wash over the top of that unconditional love, if you like, that picture, and literally do a little color wash of your favorite color and just take another breath in, another breath out. Open your eyes and that's it. It takes seconds. I mean, if you can do it for 5 minutes, wonderful. You can only do it for 2 or 3 minutes. It completely slows down your breath. It slows down your breathing and enables you to just feel so much more calm. It brings you back to the present moment. That's what we mean by mindfulness, but bringing us back to balance, as long as you're safe in the present moment. I mean, obviously, if there's, you know, tiger, then you're going to need to run, aren't you? That's why we get into the fight or flight mode, because our bodies don't know the difference between whether there's a tiger or someone coming at us with a knife or a gun, in which case, of course, the automatic response is the stress response. But most times in our lives, you know, we haven't got the tigers or the guns, thankfully. It's just everyday stress, but our body responds the same way. So we have to actually remind ourselves, remind our unconscious mind, it's okay. So we can literally use our body to remind our unconscious mind that we are safe, we're okay in this moment. I mean, that, you know, that doesn't mean that everything's going to be solved. You might still have, you know, however many bells of hell going on, but in this moment you can allow your body to know that you are safe. You're okay. In this moment, you're well. And that's everything. That sense of feeling grounded, it really is absolutely everything. So there are lots more techniques and tips that I could share with you. Do check out the Sober Club. We have lots of tips in there. I also do EFT, emotional freedom technique. So tapping techniques can be amazing as well for reducing anxiety. So if this is something that you have going on, then know that you can take back some control. You really can. You don't have to be that anxious person. There are absolutely ways of taking back a bit of control and putting in some really tiny, simple practices that can really start to make a massive difference to how you're feeling. So I really hope that you enjoy this interview about health anxiety. So my guest is Katie Georgiou. I hope I've said that right. I bet I haven't. Tell me your name. Say it for me.
Katie Georgiou.
Okay. I wasn't too far off. The author of How to Understand and Deal with Health Anxiety. So Katie is a professional psychotherapist in a GP surgery and private practice supporting performing artists. She also has written a bunch of books. This is Katie's third book, following on from How to Understand and Deal with Stress and Your Mind Matters, How to Talk About Your Mental Health. So there's so much I'd like to talk to you about, Katie, but let's just start with this particular book. And tell us, you know, what is health anxiety? What do we mean by that phrase?
So it's a helpful question, actually, to begin with, for sure, because I think when people talk about anxiety and health anxiety, we can kind of distinguish it in two categories. So there's the anxiety that a lot of people live with that they can commonly understand as anxiety. Everybody gets anxious at different points of the day. And typically we can get anxious about our health. And increasingly, that's been the case, especially since COVID and people's awareness of health and how their bodies are working is increasingly in our awareness. And so it is creating anxiety. But that's quite different to clinical presentations of health anxiety, which are more to do with the almost like the fixation on health as a theme to the point that you can't quite function during your day-to-day life. It can really get in the way of things like what you do with your day, avoiding certain foods or going out, and it can really cause panic and quite a lot of distress. And essentially, it's kind of exploring what causes that, how that presents itself and why. And my book kind of looks at the conditioning that we've arrived at in our particular culture and society, where statistics are showing that health anxiety, particularly in the clinical manifestation of it, is on the rise. Mm. And a lot of that can be put down to more around social media use, 24-hour news cycles that are kind of bombarding us with messages of doom and health issues, and quite a lot of fear mongering. Mm. And combined with that, we've just had COVID, and we've also there's a personality aspect to it as well. So if you're quite perfectionist, you have a tendency to worry a lot, you're kind of crippled with a lot of doubt. When that kind of personality trait combines with the sort of environment we're in, that can be a bit of a hotbed for breeding something like health anxiety.
Mm. So yeah. I suppose, to be flippant for a moment, you know, the phrase might be the worried well for mm. some people. It's like, you know, that they're doing all right, but yeah. they're bombarded with so many messages that they're convinced that they're not. Is there an element of that, or is that too flippant?
It's not flippant at all. And I think with a lot of these things, they're on a scale. And for a lot of people, you can be on the scale of the worried well. And very quickly, that can become something else. So if you are part of the worried well group, if we stick with that phrase, you might find that you've had instances in your life where you've experienced anxiety. Maybe, you know, you're quite high functioning, you've got a job. You've maybe experienced a few panic attacks in your life, but you are conscientious, you want to do well, you want to do the right thing, and you're getting messages around People in the news is often polarized between people who are awful or people who are perfect. And we can get into this dichotomy of feeling like if we're not at the top of our game, we're in the gutter and we're failing. And that can affect anyone. And if you've got a propensity towards shame and anxiety, that will play on you more and more. And so if you start to go through an event in your life where you're maybe on shaky ground, maybe you're transitioning, changing job, maybe you're going through a pregnancy, menopause, a big life stage of some sort, you're kind of in these shifting sands. And that's usually a time when something like health anxiety can strike, when you're feeling a bit doubtful and uncertain, and suddenly you kind of fixate on a theme and it becomes a preoccupation. So it's certainly something that can affect the worried well and can turn into a more clinical issue.
And you're absolutely right that the last few years have definitely not helped with this. I mean, the whole, COVID thing was one big, mass of fear mongering. I mean, talk about collective fear. That was one of the things that made me, I was so unbelievably frustrated at the way we were literally encouraged to be terrified. That was the starting point. Be terrified. Be terrified first, and I don't think that I just think you can't, I'm sure you know in your profession that living with that level of stress and fear literally can lead to illness, can't it? I mean, literally does. Stress, that kind of fear and terror is exactly what makes people ill. So I can absolutely see the need for your book, because I can only begin to imagine that there is a huge rise in this. There must be. I'm really interested in when you talk about the kind of how the impact of the media, the social media thing. So of course we know that there's been a really big rise in awareness of mental health issues. Sort of 10 years ago, there was nothing like the amount of conversations around mental health issues, were there really? Maybe even 5 years ago, I don't know. So on the one hand, that's a really good thing. It's a really good thing, isn't it, that people can talk about it and people can acknowledge, and young people can acknowledge that, they want to make better choices. And certainly, with the work I do, I think it very much links in, because a lot of young people, a lot of millennials are choosing not to drink, for example, because they recognize that it's going to be terrible for their mental health. So on the one hand, that's really good. That awareness is really good. But on the other hand, it puts that spotlight onto every single angle of your life. So I guess everyone is going to be thinking, oh God, well, maybe I was feeling a bit sad and down yesterday, so maybe there's something wrong with me too. I don't even know if it's a question. It's just a comment.
It's a really valid comment, and it's something I think a lot of people share. And I think it's true that the online environment has a very powerful impact on us, particularly young people. And I think you used this word earlier. You said collective when you were talking about COVID. There is a collective behavior in how we are responding to news, responding to social media, and there is a kind of collective shaming process that happens as well. So there is a kind of conditioning in a way that's taking place around how which aspects we're focusing on, what themes we need to be mindful of. And mental health conversations are coming up more and more. So there is a sense of A, people sort of potentially who have already been going through something, maybe they're feeling validated and feeling like they're seen finally, which is great for them. Particularly, I think if someone has maybe not had any particular issue in the past, may be inclined to start wondering and questioning, and possibly even feeling a bit guilty that they didn't know this stuff before, and feeling like they ought to be, and getting more involved in the conversation. And there can be a maybe a blurring of some boundaries there around what's clinical and not clinical, and when is something really an issue, and when is it okay to just talk to a friend, and when is it fine to when do I talk about it? When do I hold back? I think these questions are not fully formed and answered yet. So I think there's a lot of validity in what you're saying there. Equally, I hope I've answered what
No,
you.
you have. Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's a really interesting one, isn't it? Because, I mean, you're a psychotherapist, so you deal with this stuff. I never know how to even phrase the question, but I'll give it a go. So, how do we know whether, when someone has depression, in inverted commas, how do we know whether that is, in inverted commas, clinical, or whether they're going through some stuff? Because life is life, right? And so, for example, I'll have clients in my coaching work, and they'll sometimes say to me, I've been on antidepressants for 20 years, right? And I'll say, what happened then? Was there a clinical diagnosis? What happened? And typically the answer will be, oh, it was when I went through a divorce, or it was when such and such happened, or my parents died suddenly, and I wasn't coping very well. And so they've been on antidepressants for however many years, possibly not even though reviewed. And by the way, they're drinking a bottle of wine a night, but that's a separate issue. We'll talk about that in a moment. But my point there would be, does that mean that because they had that really difficult life experience, that they were, in inverted commas, clinically depressed and should be put on medication, or not?
It's a really important question, and these are exactly the kinds of debates that are often had within psychotherapeutic circles, in that there seems to be a bit of a faction at times between the medical view of viewing mental health and the kind of, I guess, the more systemic manifestations of it. I guess what you're talking about is circumstantial life impact. Trauma events that happen to us. And again, these things are on a scale. And what I would say is that, life is hard for everybody. There's no such thing as getting through the beginning to the end of your life without any hiccups and bumps in the road. And naturally, most people will experience things like grief, heartbreak, as you say, things like divorce, changing job. These are going to have an impact on us. They will cause stress and anxiety. And things like depression, you might go through a bout of something that you might understand to be very similar to kind of depressive experience. And many people can pass through that and then recover and be fine and go ahead. And I wouldn't necessarily call that a clinical issue. That's a response to life events, which experience. And I think that's what you're naming, that, should someone in that scenario automatically think of it as a clinical issue and go on antidepressants? Obviously, I'm not a doctor, so I can't speak from that side of things. As a therapist, what I'd say is, no, you can look at it as a very logical, creative adjustment to what's happened in your life, that of course you're going to have an experience of feeling down for a while, and it might even be quite acute and quite far-reaching and pervasive. But the question to which it's a clinical issue is on how pervasive it gets, how long it lasts for, and how much it interrupts your day-to-day to the point that you just can't function. And if obviously you've got symptoms like that long after a scenario of divorce, such as the example you mentioned, if still many, many months later you're still feeling the same and it's affecting your day-to-day life to the extent you can't function, that might be a moment where you start to consider this isn't just a circumstantial issue, there's something else going on here, and maybe I will look into getting a specific diagnosis if that feels helpful to you, because that's another issue around labeling. For some people, there are some people that find it, I find this very much in my practice. You get two camps of people often, the ones that really, really feel relieved by a label because it puts a name on what you're going through and it gives you a sense of relief that, oh, finally, I understand what's wrong, I know what I'm dealing with, and there's a solution to deal with it. Then you get the other camp of people who don't want to be labeled because of what that means, and they have a sense that that means there's something wrong with them, that they're broken and they need fixing, and then that goes into triggering feelings of shame. And for them, it can be helpful, in fact, to not think of it in that way, but to just look at it as this is how they organize their experience in the world, and having space to talk and air things is what they need, and something more therapeutic is helpful. So it really depends on what angle you're coming at it from.
That does make sense. I mean, you're right. I have I've read a few things recently, and in fact I know someone who has been diagnosed with ADHD in later life. That's quite a few people talk about that now, don't they? Sort of in their 40s, you know, they get diagnosed with ADHD. Now, for some, that's they find that really affirming that, okay, so finally I understand now there's a reason for how I am or whatever. And then for others it's a case of, well, you know, okay, so I've affirmed that, but that doesn't mean I'm going to now go on medication. You know, what can I do? So it is interesting, this whole thing around labels, isn't it? You're absolutely right. I suppose the question, you know, one question around this whole health anxiety thing is, what's normal in inverted commas? Because of course we don't want a situation where we don't care about our health, and do we? We don't want it to be like that, because, you know, if we don't ever get anything checked out, if we're not aware of what our body is telling us, then we're going to miss important signs. So that would be completely the wrong end of the extreme. But on the other hand, you know, constantly being stressed, as you talk about in your book, can you know it? I think I'm right in saying that what you're saying is that health anxiety can literally translate to physical symptoms. It's not just a case of I'm worried about something. People can actually be physically presenting with something, right? So one thing absolutely can lead to another. So what's the happy medium?
Again, such an important question, and I think what you're naming, I can imagine a lot of listeners are thinking exactly, yeah, they're probably listening right now going, yes, I can tell, from what you said. What I want to say to that is, yes, we need to be aware of our health. It's important. That's why we have all these initiatives, you know, for women having cervical smear tests, making sure that they keep up with things like mammograms, and the same for men with prostate issues. Just being, I guess, responsible around health in terms of keeping it on track, eating healthily, making sure you're exercising, all the stuff we all know in a way. But then at the same time, not to let it get to the point where it's interfering with our life to such an extent that you can't get through the day without checking and double checking. And I think this is where it starts to slip into the slightly problematic end, is when you're with health anxiety, you're constantly seeking reassurance, and it doesn't matter how many times you might be told there's nothing wrong. Perhaps you've been to the doctor a few times and you've been told you're fine, you've had a checkup, there's nothing wrong. Because of the way, unfortunately, that obviously because of the finances in the NHS, there are lots of statistics of things going missing and the symptoms being missed, and that's playing into people's fears and kind of booking appointments again to get second opinions. And so to some extent there's a logic behind that, but if it's getting to the point where you've had two or three appointments, you've got second opinions, third opinion, you're being told you're fine, but you're still checking and double checking, and you're looking online and you're finding symptoms and you're panicking that you've got a symptom like your heart is palpitating, you're convinced you're having a heart attack, you're told you're not, and then you ask someone, am I okay? And nothing that anyone says is appeasing that anxiety. That's when you can be pretty sure that you're dealing with something more along the lines of health anxiety that is. But tipping over that balance of using that word normal, that's when you might have an unusual presentation that you might think of as health anxiety.
So it's more akin to OCD in a way, when it the you know they're kind of constant intrusive thoughts, really.
Yes. So One of the symptoms of OCD, the intrusive thoughts that come up, usually with OCD there are different themes, and you can experience a fixation on particular themes, and usually these are to do with the things that you would find the most shaming. So that, the worst fear you could ever imagine that would bring upon you the most shame, you've fear that this will happen to you, so that you're going to be a bad person in some way, or commit some crime, or that someone that you love is going to die, and you get these intrusive thoughts and images that perpetuate that fear. And obviously, that's another subject. But with health anxiety, it operates in a similar way, where your fixation becomes around health. So fear. Going to die, you're going to end up in hospital, you're going to get cancer, you're going to get a brain tumor, you're going to have a heart attack. You kind of fixate on a particular theme, and that's usually a sign as well, that you're dealing with maybe something more along the lines of health anxiety.
So if somebody is in that space, then how do you support those with health anxiety? Because I hope you're not going to tell me they just get given antidepressants.
One of the things I try to draw attention to in the book is there's three layers of support you can think of. One is, what do you do if you're in crisis? So, for example, if you've got health anxiety, you're deep into it, you're panicking every day and you can't cope. That's very, very different to someone who is maybe not yet experiencing health anxiety, but might be on the way to it on account of the high levels of stress in their life, what they're going through, and their particular personality that maybe might make them likely to develop something like that. So what I would say is, if you're someone on the end of the crisis end of things, certainly, it depends how you feel about therapy, but certainly getting support from specialists in the area of health anxiety would be one option. I'm very happy to explain how you would go about doing that. But there are also things you can do alone. So you don't have to necessarily have a professional with you, but learning simple grounding techniques, breathing techniques to help you come out of a panic cycle can be very supportive. But more broadly, looking out at it more broadly than that, for the people who are not yet in that boat, it's about looking at your life as a whole and actually being more aware of what on your plate, and getting a bit of an understanding of how stressed you are and how much change is happening. Because if you're changing jobs or moving country, or you're under high stress at work, you're already sort of operating at this high anxiety level. And it's useful to be aware of that sooner rather than later, so you can start to bring that baseline of anxiety down, and just be aware of what you're watching and what you're ruminating on, and reflect and develop and cultivate some awareness and self-awareness around that. And look after yourself, put support measures in place. I talk about this thing in my book about the sandwich technique, which is about buffering a stressful situation with two supportive situations around it. So if you're about to go into a meeting, for example, and it's with a boss that you hate and you're terrified, and you hate public speaking and all of this, you can buffer that stress by doing something just before it that's supportive. And that might be calling a friend that you love. It might be getting a hot chocolate from your favorite cafe. But that's to kind of boost you just before the stressful experience. But then, as soon as the experience ends, you do something else supportive again to lift you out of it. And the idea is that it stops that stressful thing being the most important part of your day. It reduces the importance of it. And just doing little simple things like that in your day and in your life can just put you on a plane that will make you less susceptible to a crisis. I explore a lot more of how you do various versions of that in the book, but that's kind of what I would say, if you're in that camp of the worried well, particularly.
Yeah, I love that. That's taking back a little bit of control and knowing how to use, as you say, no, use techniques that can help bring you back to balance. That sounds like a great idea. I'm interested in your, when you talk about the different personality styles, tell us a bit more about that, because again, that's something that crops up a lot with the people that I work with. They'll be people who are people pleasers, really very much kind of in that wanting to please other people the whole time, to the extent that if they're stopping drinking, they'll start again just because somebody else seems to think it might be good, you know. And it's really interesting, isn't it, how our personality, how our personality traits impact on really big decisions that affect our health.
Yes, absolutely. What I would say there with personality is, in particular with health anxiety, all anxieties, in fact, probably you'll find in your history that you would always describe yourself as having always been a warrior. So if you're someone that's identifies with always being a warrior, certainly, as you said, people pleasing, but also shame. People who are quite shame focused, so they want to be good people, they want to be liked, and it's more that they're motivated towards a kind of morality that they want to be good, they want to do the right thing, they don't like getting in trouble, and getting in trouble can create anxiety. That's the sort of personality type I'm talking about, and these people tend to maybe. I'm being quite generalist here, but I certainly have identified with this as well myself. So I'm not pretending that I'm somehow outside of this, but people who can doubt themselves a lot and maybe in moments of uncertainty are quite indecisive and don't know where to place their footing and maybe defer to other people's authority for an answer and will question you know they will question their own authority. And a lot of that can come from childhood or environments where you were taught to respect authority and not necessarily listen to your own gut on things. We're brought up in that sort of world. That might make you more susceptible later to kind of not quite trusting yourself and being doubtful. And this is kind of what plays out when you have anxiety around not quite trusting your own experience and needing some reassurance from outside. That's sort of what I mean by personality.
Absolutely. Finally, can I just ask you, with your experience as a professional psychotherapist, what do you see in terms of when people are drinking, and particularly if they're drinking more than they want to? Where do you see that alcohol comes into the equation with when it's linked to stress, anxiety, depression?
I mean, we certainly have a culture for it in this country, don't we? Like, I think drinking as a culture is generally normalized. So it starts from there in a way that we come to accept that this is something we do. People drink on their own, they go to pubs. There's a bit of a culture around, which is changing, but certainly up until recently, a culture that the more you drink, the more hard you are somehow, like you're tougher, you can take your drink. So I think it starts from there and that conditioning. And once you're locked into that, there can then be this element of peer pressure that comes with that. And if you're someone that decides you don't want to drink and everyone around you is drinking, you'll often get the questions, or oh, why aren't you drinking? And that can cause all sorts of shame. So even with the best will in the world, when you try to stop, there's so many scenarios that kind of sabotage that process. And obviously, we are a nation that's getting increasingly stressed and burnt out, and so we're going to adapt to our coping strategies. And generally speaking, when it comes to what we turn to in times of stress, we tend to go to the things that worked when we were first
Yeah, in
stressed.
the past,
We did. So if you are someone that turned to food, for example, or you had an eating disorder in your childhood or early adolescence, it's more likely that when you're older and you experience stress, that might be something you're more susceptible again. And likewise, if in your teens you found that drinking kind of got rid of all your social anxieties and you felt good, that might be your go-to response later down the line, even if you didn't necessarily have a problem with it as such. Later down the line, your body will just remember that helped, and you'll kind of reach for it. It almost short circuits your logical thinking. So it can kind of begin there. And I'd say that's where alcohol kind of feeds into the cycle of stress and anxiety. That's amazing.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. I mean, what's the main thing that you hope people will get from this book? What's your sort of aim for the reader?
My aim is to kind of increase awareness and compassion. I think it's quite a misunderstood, health anxiety is quite misunderstood and mythologized. People have been using phrases like hypochondriac for a long time.
Yes.
And people also have a view of anxiety. And I think it's a way of kind of dispelling some of those myths around what it really is, how it presents. And having compassion both for yourself if you're experiencing it, because a lot of people go through it and they think they're going mad. And I want to kind of reiterate in the book that this isn't madness, this is common. And also the people who are supporting people having this experience is to kind of encourage them to understand it in a slightly different light, that this is kind of common for the age we're in, and there's ways out of it. It doesn't have to be a fixed thing that you're dealing with for the rest of your life. You can recover from it. And whether you do or don't, there is support out there. So it's kind of raising awareness and drawing attention to the compassionate way of looking at it.
Yeah, great. Thank you so much. Katie Georgiou is the author of How to Understand and Deal with Health Anxiety, published by Summersdale, and the website is kgcounselor.com. Have I got that right?
That's correct,
Yeah,
yeah.
brilliant. Thank you, Katie. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Take care.
Thank you, Katie. We'll make sure we put all of that in the show notes, the details of the book and all the other stuff. That we've been mentioning. There are some really fantastic ideas for reducing anxiety. There's lots in my book as well. There's lots within the Sober Club. So this really is something you can, take back some control of your life. Don't forget, if you'd like to join us, you want more connection, then we do have a self-care and sobriety retreat at Champneys, May the 18th to 19th. It'd be amazing to see some of you. We pack a lot into these weekends, and it would be fantastic to see you there. Just go to thesoberclub.com/events and check that out. And then, as well, we are going to be planning another live podcast recording at Club Soda in London. So keep an eye open for that. And of course, we'll do another Family Constellations at some point in Hertfordshire. So just drop me a message if you know you're interested in some of these events. It'd be really, really great to see you. Connection is just key. It really is. It just means everything to stay connected with like-minded people. So check out thesoberclub.com. Don't forget, if you want to support this work, you can go to buymeacoffee.com/JenuinelyGrace. And as always, if we can get to meet in person, mine will be a flat white. See you next time. Thank you for listening to the Alcohol Free Life podcast, brought to you by The Sober Club. Please rate and review. And if you want support, accountability and inspiration, and you want to live your best life without the booze, check out thesoberclub.com.